learned. Now, I know some people have come up to me and they said, I wasn't sure if I figured out right, so I just emailed it to your assistant. It is very tricky to figure out. It won't tell me who hasn't submitted until I submit all your grades, and then it'll tell me which ones are missing. So if you're one of the people, can you guys go online and check to see that your submission went through?
Yes.
All right. Can you all just do that and make sure your submission went through for the first round? Otherwise, it's like my secretary kind of puts out, not reasonably, very reasonably, very stressful thing for her to sit there and try and go through all 66 and like just by matching up the picture because there's no lines on them, names on them, and figure them out. So, particularly if you're one of those people who came up to me and you're like, I know I didn't go through it, just go on the UV Learns, even though it's late, it'll still let you submit it, and that way they're actually all still in one place. So that has slowed down a little bit my grading, but my plan is to just do grade all of these over spring break and get them to you afterwards. The next assignment is going to be quite different, and we'll do some sample problems at least today. They're going to more look like the kind of mini hypos, and it'll be a little bit more of a worksheet. It might be multiple choice if I can get my act together to turn it into multiple choice, but otherwise it'll be kind of like a fill in the blank little thing, but it's also open book, open notes, and you can work with each other if you want. As you kind of see, the estates and lands and the future interests have kind of a little bit of a logic puzzle kind of approach to that. So that's how we'll do that.
So we'll talk about them today. I have some sample ones that we can work on in class together today and next time. And hopefully we all will straightforward. The future interest reading in this book in particular is painful. Right? Yes. Yes. Yeah, it is not you. It is like, it's only 8 pages. 8 of the worst pages I've ever read. Yeah, it is really complicated the way they wrote it. They do not break it down in a very good way. I love this book for everything except for that section. So we're just going to try and do that together with some exercises and things in classes. They kind of jump right into the most complex things without kind of breaking it down, and we'll work on that together. But let's step back first, and what we're going to do first today is we're going to finish up all of the possessory freeholder estates. If that phrase sounds familiar, this is what I'm talking about, these things, right? And then we'll see if we get to future interest today. We might just have a very good handle on all of these by the end of the day. We'll see how far we get. So far, we did the fee simple absolute, and we started talking about the life estate. The life estate, we talked about in the context, I hope you remember, of this White v. Brown case. And we saw that one of the things that we have is,
I just want to talk about this case a little bit more because we did it just at the very end of class, and I feel like there's a few more things that might be helpful for us to think about in terms of this case.
Right, so one of the things we see is a common conundrum within the estates and lands and future interests, which is a will or a conveyance that's not written in the clearest manner. Right, so we have to try and figure this out. So we talked about that last time. We looked at what this woman wrote and tried to figure out exactly what her intention was. Did she intend to give this house entirely to her sister-in-law and say, here's this house, I hope you don't sell it, and then it's just aspirational. Things like that, that if somebody just said, gives you something and they say, I hope you use this as a farm. We don't regard that type of statement as being binding on the person who the property is given to. It's kind of this hoping, wishing, if it's hoping, wishing type language, we just say, well, it's a conveyance, and that's not going to be actually a legally binding requirement on them that they have to actually do this. So one is the idea of maybe this is like hoping, wishing language. I wish her to have my home and live in it and not to be sold. Or do we look at this as being really she's just going to live in it, and it's really just a life estate, and that she doesn't have kind of full control, that it's just supposed to be there for her life. So when we have kind of these conundrums of these languages from a conveyance that we can't quite understand what they intended, we have a couple things that we think about. We think about our presumptions, first of all, right? If we have something that feels kind of close, what should our presumption be? What was the presumption at common law? Charlotte?
The presumption was fee simple.
No, that's not the common law presumption, actually. Christian?
Common law presumption was life estate unless you include the crazy in my ears.
Exactly. So the common law presumption was for a life estate. And remember, this kind of, it feels weird to us today, but it makes some sense in context of feudal England, right? Because really, the king owned all the land, and he was just giving the land to people for their life, and so they'd come back to the map, come back to the king, or come back to the lord, and they could reconvey it to the next person. So the most common type of holding then was a life estate. Modernly, that is no longer true. Cheryl, you're right about the modern presumption. The modern presumption is a fee simple absolute. So if we're in a jurisdiction that's following the modern presumption, which is almost all of them now in the United States, we would tend to read this as being a fee simple absolute. Right? We like fee simple absolutes. They're much more straightforward. We don't have to worry about going back to the land after she died and figure out who it goes to next. It means that Evelyn, when she gets this land, she has freedom of what to do about it. She doesn't kind of have this restraint on her, somebody always kind of keeping tabs on what she does. So this is why the court has this presumption. Another presumption stated here that we won't really run into too much, but just so you understand what was going on in the case, is a presumption against partial intestacy. Right? Anyone know what that means? How about intestacy? Okay.
Intestacy is a lack of a will.
Without having
a will. Right, so intestacy is where your property goes if you haven't made a will. If you die intestate, that's dying without a will. So what happens when we have a conveyance that's not complete is we have partial intestacy. So what that means is you write a will, think about this, you write a will and you leave almost all of your stuff to people in that will, but you forgot a few things. You forgot to say where your car was going to go. So now you have partial intestacy because most of what you've conveyed is covered by your will, but you have something that you forgot. We have a presumption against partial intestacy. If we can read the will as actually conveying all of your property, we will read it in that way. This is why most people have in their will something like, and the remainder goes to, and anything else I've forgotten, all the rest of my property. They put a little phrase in there to kind of cover any of those things that maybe you forgot to put in a list. So the court is also saying, if we read her will as being a life estate, that means we would have thought she would put in one more sentence of saying what happens after the life estate. And she didn't. So it felt kind of just like a partial will, and we don't like that. We're going to kind of read it as a whole. That's not one that we run into. That presumption doesn't come up too often in our cases in this class, but I want to point it out because it's something the court found very helpful here. And then this is just this is the way they phrase the presumption in favor of a fee simple absolute. Just this is the language of the case, but this is what they're saying when they say that. So there's a presumption in favor of a grantor devise passing the entire interest of the grantor unless there's a clearly contrary words in context. That is this court's way of saying we like to find in favor of a fee simple absolute unless it very specifically says otherwise. One of the things that they get to, and let me go back to this, the phrase here, this conveyance. One of the other things that comes up in this conveyance is this idea of this restraint or this restriction on it. And what we're going to study today when we get to the defeasible fees is that there are absolutely ways that you can convey something to somebody and put rules on it. So you can give somebody your land and say, but they have to use it as a farm. That's totally permissible. But you have to do it and we'll see how you do that. But one of the things that we have in society is some restrictions that we don't feel are appropriate for you to put under it. Right? So we're actually totally okay with somebody saying, you can have my property so long as you use it as a farm. We're not okay with people putting restraints that we think are against public policy. So in this case, the restraint that's against public policy is a total prohibition on her selling the land. It's a complete, and this is the fancy word for it, a complete restraint on alienation. Right? Remember, alienation is conveying your land. So we have a total restraint on her conveying her land. We have a public policy that suggests that is against that. We don't want to have land so tied up that nobody can do anything with it. So we do not allow a complete restraint on alienation. Can anybody think of some other public policy? Something we would want to prohibit somebody to do in a restriction on land? Something would just feel like not the right thing, inappropriate.
No? James, you
like an improper use of the land. So, like, if you were to tear down the house and put like a strip club on the land or something like that. I don't know. Like just said.
We actually totally allow that. So we right. You have to think about what is it that the person conveying the land can say? Can they say no strip clubs on my land? We would allow that. That would be permissible. That would be the type of thing that we would, the type of restraint we would allow. It's not a complete restraint, right? It's a partial restraint. It's not saying you can never sell your land, you can't do anything with it. It's saying you can't be a strip club, but that would be allowed. Allison, did you have
so a lot of it going to decay, like don't use it for nothing?
Don't use it for
nothing. Nothing can happen, and then it just becomes this overwhelming pressure.
So what we need to think about is if the restraint itself would be against public policy. You're right, and that's what we would hope that they would do, but that actually would be a totally wonderful restraint. You can have this land, but you can't let it go to waste. That's a permissible restraint. What you want to think about is what is something that the person could tell you that you have to do that we think would be against public policy? All right, Caleb.
You lived in like some sort of historic home, and you put that you wanted the house to be knocked down.
Okay, so maybe that could be something. We saw kind of that come up before, right? That maybe the person is requiring you to destroy something that we think there's a public policy reason to protect. I'm giving you this painting so long as you burn it. We probably would think that there was a public policy reason to protect that. Sam?
Shifting borders. I can't, if I pass away, I can't just give my property to a different nation and say that it belongs to the country.
Okay, nobody's ever suggested that's awesome. I think that's true. You cannot declare your land that you give away to.
It doesn't happen here a lot, but I can.
Hungary? Yeah. Sorry.
You don't know what happened? You said you can't secede from your country together?
I guess so. I'm not sure that you actually have the power to do that. These are very interesting suggestions, then.
You probably get an element to spend the day, like say, if you have it, it's built a massive.
You can do that, actually. You can do that. We don't think there's a public policy against making people spend money. That's right, Nate?
Maybe you can't tell people they're not allowed to do anything
with property. That would be a complete restraint on alienation. In the same way that this is about telling somebody they can't sell it at all, you probably couldn't say you can't use it at all. There'd have to be some level of use that they were allowed.
Yeah. I thought it was just something that was racist or anti-Semitic.
Yes. I've been waiting for somebody to say, like, something illegal. Something racial, like a racial restriction. You can have this property, but you're never allowed to have any Muslims on it. That would be against public policy. You can have this property as long as you run a meth lab on it. That's against public policy. All right? So we see that this is not actually a tremendous category of things that are against public policy. And one of the ones that kind of actually comes up more often than you think is actually the restraint on alienation. Somebody who tells you you can't sell your land in any way. I put this up just because it's in the book, and I wanted to make sure that people aren't like totally flustered by it. So this is just the restraint on alienation, right? Just one of our public policy reasons that we prohibit. Now, what we would do is if we had a conveyance that had a total restraint on alienation in it, we would cross that part of it out. So you would just take your pen and you kind of would cross out that phrase with it, and then read the rest of it though it weren't there, and see who things went to. So partial restraints are valid as long as they're reasonable in duration, scope, and purpose. So a lot of the things that we just mentioned here are partial restraints. You can tell somebody that they have to use it as a farm. You can tell somebody they can't use it as a strip club. You can tell somebody you have to leave it empty for the next 10 years to allow like nature to come back. All of those are partial restraints. They're not complete. They're either limited in their duration or their scope in some way. Invalid are ones that are totally disabling. Ones that say you cannot transfer this to anybody at any time. Ones that say you're going to, if you try to transfer this, you lose your property. They're all the same thing. They're all just phrased differently. So the forfeiture is like, I give you this land, but if you try and give it away, you forfeit it.
It's the same concept as putting a restraint on it. Says, I give you this land, but you can never give away. And then the third one says, I give you this land, but you have to promise never to give it to anybody. We would just not enforce that. That would be kind of more along the aspirational idea.
I'm confused, though. If you said you need to let nature grow on it for 10 years, who's going to enforce that if you pass it away?
Well, this is true for all of the things we need. Who's going to enforce the one that says no strip club? Who's going to enforce the one that says it has to be farmed? Right? So some of these things, if they're actually recorded in the deed, can be enforced by other people who might have standing. So if they give a restraint on your thing that says no strip club, your neighbors might complain and enforce it. As we'll see with our estates and land, there's often another interest residing there somewhere. Right? So there's often an idea that if you don't comply, you will lose it. So these permissible partial restraints on alienation are the things we will see embodied in the defeasible fees. The fee simple determinable, the fee simple conditional subsequent. And in all of those, there's somebody lingering in the background waiting to take the property back if you don't do it. So maybe it's the person's heirs, maybe it's the person who they name next on the list. So, but you're right, there's no kind of like police out there monitoring everybody's land to make sure they've done what they promised. But there is probably another person out there who has an interest in making sure too, otherwise they take the property back.
There's a park downtown that a guy left to be a park, and the town, the city tried to make it a parking lot, and his heirs, well not his heirs, but his descendants fought a legal battle to keep it Jay's park.
There's tons of stories like this, right? It's just sometimes, if it's a park, like you're more likely to have kind of public attention to it, people are interested. Maybe his family, maybe just other people in the community that wanted to stay apart. But sometimes they're really small ones that are like, you can have this property so long as you like never smoke. Like, is somebody really watching that person and making sure that that happens? So, but there is an enforcement mechanism. There is somebody out there who can enforce it. Yeah.
Under invalid, so I guess I'm a little confused about forfeiture. You can, anytime we put like a partial restriction, you can say you will lose your title if you do.
No, you can, this list of the invalid ones are complete restrictions. They're not partial, right? So this is, you lose your title if you transfer your property. Because we do not want any, and this is just restraints on alienation. You cannot make a rule that says you lose your property if you try to transfer it to somebody else.
So how is that different than the disablement?
It's not very different. That's what I'm saying. It's just a slightly different phrasing of it. They're all, this is one of the things that we get when we get to estates and land. We get some very kind of annoying labels that are very tricky. Sometimes they're very close. Some jurisdictions actually do away with kind of these distinctions. So, but they both result in the same thing, but they're both slightly different phrasing. So, disabling is one that says, I give you this land, but you can never transfer it. And the other is, I give you this land, and if you try to transfer it, you lose it. It's barely a difference here. It's just semantics. And they both result in the same thing. So it doesn't, nor is anyone probably going to ever quiz you on whether something is a disabling or forfeiture. However, knowing that those are the restraints and complete restraints on alienation are impermissible, I am part. Right? Not the little details. And in fact, the only reason I really kind of point that out is because it's in the book and I don't want it to kind of sit there and confuse people. Like, what were those things? Right? It's a rather straightforward idea. You can't convey something to somebody and tell them that they're never allowed to alienate it, to transfer it to somebody else. Yeah? Sounds good. Okay. All right, let's look at the Woodrick versus Wood case. 330 in the new book. Courtney, can you help us here? It's a little complicated. We'll figure it out, though.
Left his children. Now this son wanted to move the barn that was on his lot.
Not quite. No, so let's start with the conveyance too, and then we'll get to the barn. Okay, so George Wood, that's the dad. George leaves his property, and how does he leave it? Who does he give the different property interests to?
One half to his son and one half to his wife.
And what does his wife get? Anything?
She gets interest in it until she passes.
Yeah, what is another name for that?
A life estate.
So she is a life estate. This is my very very fancy diagram I drew for you, right? Okay, so the life estate is Catherine, that's the wife. She gets a life estate. And then she says after, so this is how the remainders work, and we'll get a little bit more detail here, but she gets a life estate, and then they say the son, Sheridan, and Patricia, the son and daughter, are going to get the remainder. Basically, after mom dies, the son and daughter get to split it up, right? But this is what gets a little confusing. Do you understand, Courtney, why do I have an X over Sheridan, over the son's remainder? And let's see, what did the son do with his remainder? Well,
he gave it to his sister, he then conveyed it to her.
Almost. He does give it away, not to his sister.
He gives it to his mom.
He gives it to his mom. That makes sense. This is why you have to sometimes draw diagrams for the, or I do. I think visually, I guess. Right? So this is why I have Catherine has the remainder now. So now the ownership interest in this is kind of a weird thing, but not as crazy as some of them get, which is that the mom still has a life estate, but now the remainder is in both the daughter and the mom. Now we have to think a little bit, what this case is helping us think about is a little bit more about what it means to own a life estate and what are some of the kind of restrictions on it. All right, now Courtney, tell us about the barn.
Sheridan and Captain wanted to turn on a barn because it was rotting and we thought it would bring more value to the land and have a barn on it. But Patricia still has a major interest in the land and doesn't want the barn to be raised because she thought it would be good.
Yeah, so that's exactly it. So it's, in some ways, it's a very straightforward dispute. Here's like, not this, this is just a, not the barn in question, just a barn, right? You have an old falling apart barn, and the daughter has some reason she wants to keep it. Why do we think she wants to keep this barn? Well, you still have an idea?
Wasn't it like appraised for a certain value and she bought for the kind of value?
Well, all right, Courtney, what's the value of this barn?
$3,200.
$3,200 is like some weird value that they figure out. What is the value of the property with or without the barn versus with the barn?
I think it said it would be higher than
$3,200
without the barn.
Yeah, we have a weird thing. There's some weird math going on here. Because they actually find that this barn is decreasing the property value. This property value will be higher if you tear down this barn. Yet somehow they also calculate how much the barn is worth. I really don't understand how they do that math because it seems like it should be worth a negative amount. But they do some calculation and they don't have the details of how they make that calculation here in the opinion. But they say, okay, here's this old barn. Mom wants to turn it down, tear it down. It's going to be worth, the property's going to be worth more if they tear it down. But the daughter doesn't want to tear it down. And I don't think it's just because she disagrees with the property valuation. We don't have any details actually of why she wants to tear it down. You have some idea?
I was just going to say, I thought the book kind of implied that it might be like a personhood.
That's what they're guessing. Like, yeah, it's not clear, but it is perhaps an idea that she has fond childhood memories in this barn, or you know, she used to play in here. Maybe she thinks it's pretty. Maybe she's mad at her mom. Like, we don't actually know, but she is arguing that that she does not want this barn now.
I think somewhere in there it also mentioned that she was storing her stuff in that barn.
Maybe she wants it as a storage space. I don't know. We don't have a lot of detail about that, but we can think about whether it matters to us that she, what her reasoning is of what she feels about this barn. Okay, so notice that there's property interest here. There's one property interest that's possessory. The life estate, the mom's life estate, we call that a possessory property interest because she is actually possessing the property. She's the one occupying it. She's there. She's living on it. And what Patricia has is a non-possessory interest. She has a future interest. Right? It's not even a non-possessory current interest. It's a future interest that she has. She will one day have this property. Having that future interest, even though she cannot go on the property and do anything to it today, can be pretty powerful. It can be powerful in the way that it means she could go and get a loan out on it. She could actually sell that to somebody. She'd be like, hey, my mom's 80. I'll sell you my interest. You're going to have this property when she dies. I don't know when that'll be, but I can sell it to you. But it also means that she has some say, perhaps, in what goes on the property today. Right? If you can think about it, I'm the one who's going to get this property in the 20 or so years. Maybe I should be able to have some say in what's done with that property today. So this is what she's trying to do. And this brings us to the doctrine of waste, which is something that we see with life estates. All right. So, Courtney, what is the waste argument? You mentioned this in passing.
The waste argument is that when you tear down something that changes the identity of the land in any way, then it's considered wasteful. And that's either injuring the property. That's common law.
So at common law, what were the rules for waste?
At common law, anything that altered the identity of the land, whether it was improving it or having it be detrimental to the waste.
Yeah, so at common law, anything that changed the physical character of the land. We often think of this as somebody who like tears down the house. Maybe we think about it as somebody who goes and cuts down all the trees in the forest. Maybe they dig up all the minerals. They've actually kind of done a lot to the land that changes the physical characteristics of the land. And you think as the future interest sitting there waiting around for it to become yours, you're going to be pretty upset if the present-day tenant has chopped down all the trees. Right? You can think of this in some ways as not being too dissimilar to kind of a landlord-tenant relationship, right? You have some ability to do things on your property that you rent, but because there's somebody else out there who has this property interest, they have an interest in really paying close attention to what you do and prohibiting things that are going to damage the property. So it's that same idea from landlord-tenant, but at a much bigger scale, right? Because a life tenant could be there for years and years. So the common law approach, the doctrine of waste, was quite expansive. It originally developed to resolve disputes between life tenants and the remainder man, the future interest. And it also included, and it was really to get at this idea that you might be reducing the property value and that wouldn't be fair. In Woodrick, one of the things they talk about, though, is whether or not they should look differently at ameliorative waste. Right? So Ohio had never kind of figured out what it thought about ameliorative waste. And what in the world does that phrase mean, Courtney?
It means that destroying something
where
actually increase the value of the land.
Yes, exactly. So ameliorating, right? Like, you are physically changing the characteristics of the land, but you're actually doing something that is going to increase the property value. You actually, you're doing something that's going to be good for the land. You're going to, okay, you're tearing down the house, but you're building a newer, much nicer house? That's like ameliorative waste, right? You're taking out the old windows, but you're putting in new ones. You're changing the physical nature of the property, but you're doing it in a way that actually could increase the value. So here, let me just, here's kind of the types of waste that we see courts using these phrases sometimes. Voluntary waste. It's an affirmative act that significantly reduces the property value. This is just like I go out there and I cut down all the trees, I knock down the house. I take an action that I know is going to reduce the property value, but I have my own reasons for why I want to do it. Maybe it's spite to the person who's coming next, but maybe it's just the use I want of the land is a meadow, not a forest. I think that's nicer, but I'm reducing the property value by a lot. Voluntary waste, not permissible. Permissive waste. this is now your failure to take care of something. Permissive waste is usually involves a structure. It could involve, I don't know, like maybe it could involve a forest if you didn't do a good job of keeping pests out or disease spreading or something like that. But it's usually mostly in the context of a house. So you have a house and you just fail to do any repairs. You just sit there and you watch the holes in the ceiling and the roof be ruined, and you know the windows are all broken, so every time it rains, the second floor is really damaged. You kind of sit there and watch the damage happen, and because you think, it's only going to be my house a few more years. You know, I'll let the next person deal with it. So it's not that you've taken, so the voluntary waste is you've actually undertaken an action to commit that waste. You have gone out and torn the house down. You've gone out and chopped down the trees. The permissive waste is you kind of are just not a good life tenant. You're just not good at taking care of this land, and it's getting damaged. Ameliorative waste, then, is, as we said, it is the waste that actually increases the value. At common law, all of these were prohibited. Ohio is suggesting perhaps it should take a different stance. What is Ohio's conclusion here?
They conclude that as long as it doesn't injure property and it increases the value, it's okay. Fair enough.
All right, the court here also awards her that value of the barn. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I don't know. I find that really strange. I think that it doesn't, I don't think it makes that much sense. If the barn's demolition actually increases property value, you have increased that, you've increased the value of Patricia's interest. So to actually also pay her for the barn seems, it is unusual. It is not something other courts would do. I don't think that is actually the standard process that in any way that you would pay your future interest for what? Because you're increasing the value of the land. So what do you guys think about this rule? Does this make sense? Do we all feel like this was appropriate, that we demolished the barn, but we kind of, because it's going to help the property value?
Wouldn't there be a conflict between permissive and ameliorative waste? Because let's say that she chooses not to knock down the barn, and then the barn just collapses itself into different such as repair. Like, where does she win?
You're right. So we might have, the mother here might be in quite a conundrum. If she sits there watching this barn fall apart, she's perhaps could get accused of permissive waste. Now notice waste, this doctrine of waste, it allows the future interest, those people who are sitting around waiting for you to die, it allows them to come in and take action against you. It allows them to bring, seek injunctive relief, stop you from tearing down the barn. It allows them to come in and actually, if the damage is already done, seek money from you. Right? Your permissive waste led to the destruction of this house. You just diminished my future interest. You owe me money for how much you've done. So you can see how it is actually an action, but the future, it's a doctrine that helps the people who are holding the future interest come in and do something to try to protect their future interest through injunctive relief or perhaps through payment of damages. Okay.
I understand that the mom has a possessory interest in the life estate and then there's people who have the future interest. I'm just confused. So who owns the house?
All three of them.
So
we don't always own in fee simple absolute. Sometimes we have an ownership that's really messy. So if this is the world of this property, and we'll pretend I can draw an infinite line that's this long. All right, that's an infinite line. All right, so she has a life estate. The rest of the property is divided up between one half her and one half her daughter. And that is the entire ownership of the estate. It is just a weird ownership because it means that her daughter's one half of the interest can influence what she does. You can think of this as almost like if two people own a piece of property today, you should be able to like figure out, like you should make sure that your partner isn't going to destroy the land. So it's just that her property interest is a little different than what we're used to. It's just this like weird future interest hanging out there.
So if they fail to pay the mortgage, they're all on the hook for that.
So usually, you would say the life estate person.
So that's what these people sitting out here waiting. And there's two places where we see waste. One is a life estate, and the other one we see, the book didn't really mention in passing, but doesn't talk about much, is a term estate. So instead of saying to Catherine for life, we could have said to Catherine for 20 years. Both of those are ones that are kind of a fixed duration. I mean, we don't exactly know when she died, but we know it's like, we know that she will one day die and where it goes next. So those two, the life estate and the term estate, are the ones where the doctrine of waste comes in. Does that make sense? We won't do it with all of our future interests, but some of them. Yeah.
So in this case, is it an ameliorative of waste or is it no waste? Because they say
it's not waste. They basically say it's just again semantics. What this looks like is ameliorative waste, and some is what you would put it in a category. This, and some courts will say this is ameliorative waste, and ameliorative waste is permissible. This court just says it doesn't qualify as waste at all. We're not going to give it that label waste. It's just a semantics thing, but it's the same idea, right? That because they didn't have a doctrine of ameliorative waste in Ohio, they just kind of said, we don't think of this type of thing as waste. It comes out as the same result, which is that it's allowed. Anyone have any concerns? Anybody feel sympathetic with the daughter here?
I just have a quick question about the category of ameliorative waste. If it's still considered by the court as waste, is that then that's considered permissible waste as opposed to...
Yeah, just be careful with your categories here, right? I don't want you to say permissible because I feel too much like permissive. It is waste that we are not going to allow an action to proceed against them. So it's just, you can see some jurisdictions are going to say, this isn't waste at all. They're fine. You can go turn and tear down the barn. Other jurisdictions are going to say, this looks like ameliorative waste, which we allow. You're fine. Go tear down the barn. If somebody was really adhering to the common law, and I don't know of a jurisdiction that adheres that strictly to common law anymore, there might be one out there that doesn't actually allow any waste. So they would say, even ameliorative waste, you can't do. If there's some reason why, sometimes that might be something we could see why you would adopt that stance. If our property desires are not just the value of the property, if it's, you know, here, the calculation for whether or not it was ameliorative waste, whether or not, you know, it was just based on the value of the property, the monetary value of the property. But we've talked about in this class that people have other connections and values that they set to property. So we could see, actually, she might be quite, maybe she doesn't care about the money, and making the decision based on the fair market value actually robbed her of her real interest that she had in the property, which was a personhood interest, perhaps. Okay.
So, I'm saying that
under the common law, none of that is permissible. Nothing that actually changed the characteristic of the land was permissible. Whether it made a good change or a bad change, you could not do it. But the more modern rules, if you make a good change, and you seem to measure goodness in the market value of the land, if you change the land in a way that increases how much you could get it for in a sale, we're going to say, well, you can do that one. Yeah? Okay. Let's see. Oh, okay. Yeah, I had another slide on it. Right, so that's just the common law, right? Anything that alters the identity of the premises is waste, regardless of whether the act happened to be beneficial or detrimental. That's just the restatement of what we've just been talking about. But the modern view, the majority view, is that beneficial use of the property is okay, as long as you don't decrease the property value. All right, let's look at fee tail. We have a lot of people in here who are big Pride and Prejudice fans. I was impressed. A lot of people put that down as their favorite book. What about this one? Anyone recognize that building?
Downton Abbey.
All right. These are really... thank God for Downton Abbey and Pride and Prejudice, because otherwise nobody would have an idea of what I'm talking about when we talk about fee tail. Sometimes I show clips, so I can't get them to work today. All right. Fee tail. Again, this makes sense if we think about the context of like feudal England and the development of the laws in England about where property went. Right? Because at first you could not keep the property in your family. The property would go back to the king and go back to the lord. People really objected to that, particularly the more powerful people. So not the serfs, but really the knights and the lords were objecting to the king doing that. They really wanted to make some rule where they could pass on their title, they could pass on their land to their family. So they created a new type of fee, which is this fee that stays within your family. So now think about this. It's not like a fee simple absolute in that you can give it to whoever you want. It has to go to your family. It has to stay within your family. And if we remember, we have always these magic words, these words of limitation. And it's, and instead of it just being A and her heirs, it's like A and the heirs of her body. That's our magic little phrase, the heirs of her body. Sometimes people will say in detail, which I appreciate, it's a little bit clearer. But otherwise, it's, look at this thing, heirs of her body. The property right that we say A has is a fee-tail property right. It is a restricted property right where A is required to pass that property down to her lineal descendants. And so the heirs of her body means not just like, you know, our heirs could be... Well, it has to pass down to somebody who's a blood relative of yours, basically. It's not just anybody who you might leave your land to. It's not just, you know, sometimes, in some, heirs means it's going by intestate succession, and there's some jurisdictions where if you get into the complicated factors, you can actually go to, like, a cousin or a stepsister or something like that. It could not in this. It has to go to your blood relatives. It has to go to your kids and your grandkids going back. Some places, and this is where we, this is Pride and Prejudice in Downton Abbey, sometimes it's the male heirs of the body. That was actually the most common formulation. So that meant if all you had were daughters, what's his name, Grantham?
Or Mr. Collins.
Mr. Collins. Wait, but what's the dad's name?
Mr. Bennett.
Mr. Bennett, right? Mr. Bennett has all daughters, right? He can, and even though he's a relatively wealthy man, he cannot help his daughters. He cannot give them his money. Lord Grantham cannot pass on his estate or his title to his daughters because it was fee-tail with the male heir. So they have to find kind of like the second cousin out there who's the, like the remaining male heir who's going to come in and take the property. And you see, not in Pride and Prejudice, in Pride and Prejudice they just lose, the family loses the land and goes to Mr. Collins. It's been a while. But and I've only gotten through season one of Downton Abbey, so tell me nothing. But you do hear them talking about how they want to get rid of it. It's like when, in the first couple episodes, they're like, we need to break the fee tail. You know, it's like the dowager, the mean old lady and the mom. Yeah, let's join together and figure out how to get out of this because it was so restricted in that way. What we have left after a fee tail, we say A has a fee tail, and we say O has a possibility of reverter, of reversionary interest. Why is that? Why does O still have anything?
Mary. Well, would it be if A didn't have any descendants?
Yes, and it can be anywhere. It could be like 100 years from now. It could be 200 years from now. If somewhere that line, A's whole line of descendants dies out, there's nobody left, right? It would go back to O. So we'd have to do some detective work there, right? If there was actually nobody in the family, no male heirs anywhere, or maybe it's no heirs at all if it goes to male or female heirs, we have to do some detective work. Maybe it was 5 years ago, but maybe it was 500 years ago. We have to go back and figure out who actually owns this property then. So there's always somewhere lingering out there this possibility of reverting.
Is O always a king or a monarch? Like, are they always the people giving the land?
I mean, if you go back far enough.
Okay.
If you go back far enough, it could be from the king, and we'll go back to the then it would go back to the state. But not necessarily. It could just be you definitely have people in the United States where we didn't have kings or monarchs who left things in detail because of their desire to keep their property in their family. And you know, so that's why they do things.
So is the detail just a possible restraint? Kind of?
Yeah, it's a partial restraint on alienation. Yeah, right? Because it's a pretty strong restraint on alienation, though. It's such a strong restraint on alienation that courts disfavor it. Right? It's not a complete one, but it's pretty close because you can only transfer this property to one person, only to your lineal descendant. Right? You don't have freedom of how you... So it's a restraint on alienation, and because the courts disfavor that,
They created it. They here in the United States, we have largely prohibited the fetale. Now, the reason we even have to ever think about the fetale is because we might still have them lingering around out there. And we have to figure out, well, now that it's prohibited, how do we interpret these? And every now and then you have somebody who tries to write one, and you have to think about, okay, now that it's illegal, what does it mean? What do we turn it into? Yeah.
So if it's hundreds of years later, going back to O, how do you decide which O was a number?
It's O's heirs, right? So it's like I was saying, it could be total detective work to track down who are O's heirs. And you would just, and heirs are by intestacy, so it's not who he left things to in his will. Unless he specifically, O could have actually left it. You can leave a possibility of reverter in your will, so it could have been written down in the wills over the generations, by the way, you get my possibility of reverter. Otherwise, it's this weird detective work where we'd have to go and figure out. So one day, maybe one of you guys will get a phone call that says, you and your siblings are the heirs of somebody you didn't know existed, and you'll get this thing. All right.
Can you not claim adverse possession since you already found, like, you were the last person to own it or have it for a long time, rather than going back so far away and trying to find out what it was? Can you just claim, hey, I owned it for such a long time, it's mine now, or anything like that?
Well, you'd have a little bit of a trouble meeting all of the requirements of adverse possession because of hostility, right? You're actually there with somebody's permission. In some way, right? You are not actively saying, I am breaking the fetale, Nana, it's mine now, I'm taking it over. You could, perhaps, however, develop some circumstances where you do that, where it actually has a legally passed out of your family, but none of you guys, but you don't actually move out or something like that, and you could try. And there's other doctrines. I'm sorry your book doesn't cover it because it's weird because they refer to it, but they took it out of the more recent editions, which is an idea of latches. Did you guys study latches in any other class? No, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's weird. Your book has, like, there's a place in the book where they're like, perhaps you remember when we talked about latches in chapter 3. And I'm like, you took that out of the book. You don't talk about latches in chapter 3. Latches is an idea. I'll just introduce it so you know that phrase. And because it's not in the book, we won't do too much with it. But it's an idea that you kind of meet all of the requirements for adverse possession but one. Usually the hostility or something like that. And we just feel like a court in its equitable jurisdiction, in its ability to kind of figure out something that's fair, will sometimes invoke the doctrine of latches, which is kind of like, you sat by and watched them do this, so you can't now complain about them taking the land. So there's some idea perhaps of latches in there, like, you kind of have, it just would feel unfair to take it away from them if they've lived on it forever. So there is maybe some doctrine back there that might save these people. But really, you're going to come up against fetales so infrequently. Here is just the modern rules about fetale. Right? It is allowed still in some form in these four states. Delaware, Maine, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island do allow some form of fetale. Usually they'll put some cap on it or something like that. Like it can only last, 100 years or something like that. This is how other states have interpreted this. Have interpreted it, though. Other states will say, "Oh, you read something that's a fetale, it's a conveyance, and the person has written to the heirs of her body. We are going to interpret that as meaning to be a life estate in the first person name, and then just fee simple absolute in the next person. We're not going to keep it going on generation after generation." Some states just treat it as a fee simple absolute to start with. They don't even get that first person of life estate. These are kind of the three options that we see happen. If you see something written as a fetale, like, what would you do with it? You'd have to look at the state. And this is just kind of another way of phrasing each of those things. Does that make sense? All right. Any questions about these first three? Fee simple, absolute, life estate, or fetale? All right, let's do the defeasible fees a little bit before break. Okay. Defeasible. Now, here's something that I feel. Here's two words that people seem to often get confused. Defeasible and determinable. Right? Just be careful which one you're saying. Defeasible means to cut short. It is a fee title. You have a type of fee title. You have a possessory estate. You're actually living there, working on it. It's your land. Or you don't have to live there, but it's like your land today. As opposed, it's not a future interest. But it's an interest that could get cut short. It's an interest that you could lose.
And this is different than a life estate. We know people lose their life estate or their term of years interest, but it's very clear when they lose that.
It's like written into it. You lose that at the end of your life. You lose it when the 20 years expire. This is one that has an uncertainty to it.
If you do a certain thing or if you fail to do a certain thing, you're going to lose your property.
These are all partial restraints and alienation, but they're all ones that we find to be acceptable.
Fee simple determinable, fee simple subject to condition subsequent, fee simple subject to an executor limitation. Those are just the three different types of fees that you could end up losing.
And they all have slightly different rules about who's going to get it and how and when they'll get it.
So let's start with the first one, the fee simple determinable.
I'll explain that weird picture in a minute. All right, fee simple determinable is a person's right to present interest terminates automatically when a specific future event occurs. Right? To A and her heirs, let's see, is that down here? Oh, that's weird. Okay, I have it backwards. Okay, from A to O to A and her heirs, so long as Black Acre is used for agriculture. Right? So A is actually getting this property. And we can look at some of these phrases, right? O to A and her heirs sure sounds like a fee simple absolute. We see the magical words, the words of limitation that tell us it's a fee simple absolute. Unfortunately, the sentence doesn't end there. It then has so long as Black Acre is used for agriculture. That so long as, these are words of duration, tell us that A might lose the property. A is going to lose that property if she stops using it for agriculture. And when I say A in this context, I mean A and whoever gets the property after A, right? It continues the interest, right? So it's a fee simple absolute. So what we say is that A has a fee simple absolute, something that she can totally transfer, she can leave in her will, she can it can go to her to heirs through intestacy. But that restriction, so long as it's used for agriculture, remains on that land. So then what happens if we stop using that land for agriculture? Who gets it, do you think?
Okay. Goes back to the grantor.
Goes back to the grantor. O will get that land back. And O gets that land back automatically. The second it stops being used for agriculture, it automatically reverts back to O. We fulfill the condition that says that A loses the land.
What we call A's right, which is a fee simple, we call it a fee simple determinable because it's one that could terminate. Whenever Black Acre is no longer used for agriculture, A and her heirs do not have the right to the property anymore. It goes straight to O. Does anybody know? This is jumping ahead to future interest a little bit. Does anybody know what we call O's interest then? Allison? It's a type of reverter interest. And we can always think of reverter or reversions as the things that are going back to O. It's a type of reversionary interest. In this case, we call it a possibility of reverter, because it is not a certainty that O will ever get it back. It's just a possibility that O will get it back. Right? There's a possibility that one day it won't be used for agriculture and O will get it back. Notice that means O has not a possessory interest, but O does have a future interest. This is a type of future interest, though, that does not come with the doctrine of waste. Remember, I said the doctrine of waste is just for life estates and term of years. So O has some interest and can sit there and enforce this idea of the agriculture, but it doesn't actually have kind of the other type, doesn't have the power of waste. The reason I have that picture up there of Frank Sinatra is, for some reason, Barbary always uses this. This is like a very common, mnemonic device that they use in bar review classes. So I give it to you now. So you're in. Frank Sinatra doesn't prefer Earl Redenbacher. I did not make that up. I would have come with something stupider. But funnier, I mean. All right. So fee simple determinable always is followed by a possibility of reverter. Anytime you are able to label the fee interest as a fee simple determinable, you don't even have to think about what the next thing is. It's a possibility of reverter. This will help us when we get to the fee simple, to the future interest. But right now, I just want to kind of make sure we understand what the rules are for the fee simple determinable. Okay.
the when O gets the if O does end up getting the property back, if the agricultural if they stop using it for agriculture, what he ends up with? What do you think? What would O have in the end of the day if he ended up getting that property? If it was used for agriculture, if they stopped using it for agriculture, reverts back to O. What does O then have? Fee simple absolute. Right, because there's no restriction on O's use if he gets it back. Does that feel good or painful? Good? All right. Let's see. All right. Now we will see that there are two types of restrictions where the land work that look very similar. There's two types of ways that we could figure out what we think is going to happen when the condition is filled. In the fee simple determinable, A automatically lost her land when it stopped being used for agriculture. We could write these conveyances in a slightly different way that suggests that A doesn't automatically lose her land, but O has the power to come back and take her land if he wants to. Do you see the difference here? One is that the second it stops being used for agriculture, A has lost that land. It is not hers, and O can file a quiet title action or action for ejectment or use self-help in the old days. And a fee simple condition subsequent looks a little bit different. It says if A stops using her land for agriculture, then I have the right to come back and take it. So this is the condition subsequent idea. It means that there's something that has happened afterwards, and that gives me the right to come back in and retake the land. This is nicer for A in some ways, because she doesn't lose the land automatically. But it can also lead to some confusing things. Okay, so the person's right to present possession can be terminated if O re-enters and retakes possession. It does not automatically go to O. Let's see. I have my slides in the backwards order. I'll go through this slide, and then I should have done these in a different order. But so it can be sometimes very hard when you're looking at a phrase to figure out whether it's one of these fee simple determinable ones that ends automatically, or if it's a fee simple condition subsequent one where O actually has to come back in and physically do something before the property goes back to O. The courts have determined that certain phrases indicate one and others indicate the other. I find this annoying, but these are just words to learn. It's just like make yourself a little cheat sheet and keep these words beside you. Fee simple determinable, if our words of purchase are always just the who it goes to A. Our words of limitation are the words and her heirs, right, that told us that it was going to be a fee simple absolute. The words, but we add to those words of limitation, we add words of duration, that so long as idea, that indicate that it's not a fee simple that goes on and on. And on. And here's some examples of the words of duration. So long as, while, until, during. Do I have one more? Yeah, during. The courts of all kinds of, those all look like words of duration. So long as it's a farm, while it's a farm, until it's no longer a farm, during the time that it's a farm, all of those have a temporal element to it. We're going to label those as words of duration, which means we check off our box that says fee simple determinable. The fee simple condition subsequent looks similar in that it has the same words of purchase. It's still going to be like 2A. Same idea of words of limitation, 2A and her heirs, or just if it's silent on 2A, we assume fee simple absolute, right? That those just tell us what the fee simple idea. But now instead of words of duration, we have words of condition. Provided that, but if, on the condition that. Now, some of you might be very good at linguistics or semantics or something like that, and be able to look at these words and feel very certain in yourself. Ah, yes, those are certainly, that first list is clearly temporal durational words, and that second list is clearly the conditional words. I am not one of those people. I just have to keep those lists next to me and remember and check which one it is. But that's the idea, right? The idea is that this provided that, but if on the condition that, don't have the same time sense to it, don't have the same sense of duration, but have more of a sense of putting a condition on it. So if you have, we have to just look carefully at the words of the conveyances. All right, so here's a fee simple determinable example. All right, O to G and her heirs until Alaska secedes from the United States. What are our words of purchase? To G, right? Just that part. Just say where it goes. What are our words of limitation? And her heirs. And what does it tell us that means? Fee simple absolute. But unfortunately, our sentence doesn't end, so we know it's going to be a different type of fee simple. All right. Now it says, until Alaska secedes from the United States. Durational or conditional?
Durational.
Durational. So you can see how if I hadn't just given you that list, it feels almost conditional. Or maybe it doesn't to you, but maybe it's very straightforward. All right, so then we say, right, so that means if it's durational, what does G have? What's the property right we give G in this? It's on the top of the slide. Fee simple determinable. If it's fee simple determinable, what does O have? Possibility of reverter. Always remember that stupid Frank Sinatra doesn't refer Orville Redenbach, right? It always just always goes together. And it'll make a little bit more sense once we do the future interest. Alright, fee simple determinable under the common law was not divisible or assignable. What that means is you could not leave it to somebody in your will. And you could not sell it to somebody. So if you had a fee simple determinable, you had this fee simple, you had to use your land for agriculture, it could only pass to your heirs. You couldn't actually sell that. And that's why figuring out the labels would matter. If you figured out what the right label was, that would tell you if you were allowed to transfer your property to somebody and what methods of transfer were acceptable. Modernly, we don't care anymore. We say all of these things are alienable, divisible, and descendable. And part of that is probably because we have better land recording records now. We're actually able to pull up the deed. And the fear before was that, oh, you had this restriction on your land that said it had to stay a farm. Maybe, you know, if you keep passing that along, maybe the future people won't realize that restriction is there. Now that we can just write that restriction right into the deed, people feel a little bit better about our ability to kind of transfer that around. Feel like it should be fine. All right, so fee simple subject to condition subsequent. All right, we looked a little at the magic words already. All right, this is a fee simple estate that's created in a transferee. Fancy way of saying it's just I'm transferring my land to somebody. Same as O to A, right? But it could be terminated at the election of the transferor when a certain condition or event occurs. It does not automatically transfer. The transferor has the power to end it, but does not automatically end it. This is something that courts, jurisdictions use slightly different phrases. I tend to call it a right of re-entry. Your court actually calls it a right of entry, which is less commonly used. Sometimes you call it a power of termination. You see, all of those phrases make sense. They're all saying that O has the right to come back in and retake the land. O has the power to terminate your interest in that land. It used to be a common law that O's power to do so was via self-help. So if O saw that you stopped using the land as a farm, O could just go back in and use physical force, self-help, to kick you off the land. We don't really like that anymore. Now, most times, people file a quiet title action or maybe an action for ejectment or something to show that they have title in the land. Here, we could see, if O fails to do so, start thinking about whether that should introduce us to ideas of adverse possession or latches. If O never comes and kicks you out, even if they could have, we could see how in some jurisdictions you could get adverse possession. Other jurisdictions would be kind of hesitant about the hostility argument.
Does that also mean, like, the grantor can come check it out and then walk around the property at any time, or is it more of a technical term saying take it back? Like, I think of a landlord walking your
apartment. Well, if O has a future interest in your property, usually we would say they have some ability to kind of check on it. There's nothing clear as to, like, how often they get to monitor and or in what way. But yeah, I mean, generally we would say that they have to have some ability. If they have a property interest, that possibility of reverter, or sorry, in this case it's a different type of remainder. But if they have that, reversionary interest, yeah. Okay, so and again, just those, we have to just remember those magic words. Last one, and then we'll do, okay. I forgot. So this is just another example of another way you might say it. This one is nice and clear because it has both provided that, it has both those magic conditional words, and they very kindly also wrote, may re-enter and take possession. If you were writing one of conveyances of these for somebody, I suggest making it really clear, putting in both those phrases. Right, so A has a fee simple subject to condition subsequent, and we say that the condition subsequent is the land no longer being used for agriculture if we had identified what the condition is. If O, we say, has the right of reentry or the power of termination. So you can see, again, your future interests are clearly outlined by determining what our possessory estates are, which is why I always find the most helpful first step is to figure out what is the possessory estate, and that'll help give you the right label for the future interest. So if you label your possessory estate as a fee simple, subject, condition, subsequent, you know that the future interest is a right of reentry. Jamie?
So do you find this language in the deed?
Yeah, in the deed or in a will, you know, or anywhere that a person is conveying property. It could be in a contract, like any type of document where a person is conveying property, because we allow this to be passed by will or passed by sale. Yeah. You see it a lot, and I feel like you see these mostly in wills when people are leaving their land to somebody. There's a lot of times when they've kind of put this language for what they hope will happen to the land. And otherwise, you see it in donations, right? So not generally when we sell. If you sell somebody your land, you don't generally put that many restrictions on it. But maybe if you donate your land, like the park, you'd be like, we'll donate this land so long as it's used as a park. It's a way to kind of embody your wishes. Those are the places you most commonly see these things. Come on. I have that slide twice for some reason. Okay, let's do this case. You up for it? Can we do one more case before break? You can do it. Come on, stand up and stretch if you need to. Jump up and down. All right, Peter, can you help us with the Marinholtz case?
Yeah. So they left the land to school trustees. The condition that
it be
used for school purposes?
Yeah, I want to correct one thing. They didn't leave it. It wasn't in their will. It was actually conveyed to them.
Okay.
Right. So they were still living. That'll make a little bit difference in our facts. Right? In 1941, right, the Huttons give their land to the school district for what purpose?
School purposes.
Okay, school purposes. All right, then what did the school district then do with the land?
So it's used as a school for a while, but then ultimately it's not a school anymore. It's like used to store school supplies. Right?
Yeah. So we have to look at this phrase, right? The land could be used for school purposes only, otherwise revert to grandkids. Does that look to you like a fee simple determinable? Or fee simple condition subsequent?
Well, that's kind of the issue in the case. It's not entirely clear.
Uh-huh. How do we figure it out?
Well, we got to look at the length. I don't know. We don't have any of the key.
Yeah, don't be fooled by my writing that provides that. It's not in the language of this thing, right? We don't have any of our magic words. We don't have until or while or on the condition that this is annoying, right? So now we have to figure out whether or not we think it seems like the type of thing that they meant to automatically revert to them, or the type of thing where they were expecting to kind of exercise a right over the entry to come back in, right? We do see they want it to go back to the grantors. We see that they have this desire for it to be defeasible. They only want it to be used for school purposes. It's just not clear kind of the end. Harry, you have a question?
Sorry, it sounds like a fee simple determinable because it says otherwise revert to. So it's almost like automatic to me, at least the way I see it.
Yeah, but that otherwise is not a durational word. So that's why it is kind of confusing. I agree with you. We could definitely interpret it that way, that they seem to want it to be otherwise to revert. Seems like it maybe should be automatically revert. I don't know. Peter, what do you think?
I'm going to go with condition subsequent just because of the last revert to grantors here, and that kind of suggests that they want that if it's not being used for purposes, they want to come back.
Yeah. So this case is very complicated. Let me see if I have a slide. This is a very complicated case, right? So we're just talking about the Huttons, who are the ones who gave the land to the school district, and the school district, and yet the Marinholtz are the ones making the claim. What is their claim to this land based on?
So, yeah, that's kind of good. But isn't it that because once the land stops being used for school purposes, then they have title to the land?
Why would they be the ones to have title? Why wouldn't they go back to the Huttons?
Because it's in the, I don't know, like the, maybe a prior estate left.
Yeah.
Like they have interest in a prior estate, and then once the Huttons give it to the school, they lose the interest, and then their future interest comes back into play.
It is complicated. Like, this is a case that you really have to kind of sit there and almost draw a timeline and figure out what's going on. They actually are making two assertions for ownership. There's two different ways that they are suggesting that they own it. First route is that in conveyances that aren't really mentioned by the court, they end up with the Huttons sell their property to the Jacquemains, and then the Jacquemains then convey it to the Marinholtz. So right, so the property is just conveyed. In the conveyances of the property, it also had a line in there that says, "I also include any future interest I've retained in the Hutton school property." So notice now, whatever the Huttons had, whether they had the power of termination right of reentry, or they had the possibility of reverter, whatever one of those it is, they don't name it. They don't label it. But it's now we see that it's in modern, the modern rules would be that they could transfer it. Arguably. Common law would say they can't. So this is why it gets tricky, right? If they were allowed to transfer it or not. Makes some difference. Okay, so all right, so they say, okay, well, the Huttons gave me whatever their future interest is. So at some point before they die, the Huttons must have conveyed their property interests, and they ended up with them. Now, if it's a fee simple determinable, if we read that as a... Oh, here's just the timeline, right? All right. If it's a fee simple determinable that they have conveyed when they conveyed their future interests, what would that mean?
That would mean that.
What would Marinholtz end up with? What would the property interest be that Marinholtz has?
They would get the.
What do we call that future interest that they end up with? If we label it a fee simple determinable. That language, as Jairo is suggesting, what is the future interest that goes along with a fee simple determinable? It's always the same one. Every time we say fee simple determinable, there's another one that goes with it. Jairo?
Possibility of reverter.
That's a stupid Frank Sinatra thing that's really unhelpful, I guess. But like, right? It's a possibility of reverter. So one line of their claims. The Marinholtz are making two claims. One line of their claim is that we inherited from the Huttons what they had, and we should have inherited their possibility of reverter. That means the second you stop using it for school purposes, it should be ours. The other route, the other route is that perhaps it doesn't pass through that way. Perhaps it didn't lose. They also make a claim based on land that they get from the son. The Huttons died intestate. They had one son, Harry. And Harry got Harry inherited whatever they had. We are not clear what type of reversionary interest they might have had. So Harry, I don't know if Harry's crazy or what, but okay, in 1969, Harry inherits. In May of 77, Harry transfers his interest to the Marinholtz. He's like, I don't know what I have, but whatever I have, it's yours. This should seem to put him, the Marinholtz, in pretty good state, having two property ways that they got the property, possibly. Although a couple months later, Harry says, I never did that. And he instead releases his property interest to the school. So Harry doesn't really want it. It's just like, did he give it to the school or did he give it to the Marinholtz? It's like a little bit unclear. So that is like the kind of overly complicated, like, background facts here. The Merenholtz are now bringing a quiet title action. What's tricky here is trying to figure out whether we label this as a fee simple determinable or a fee simple condition subsequent. But Peter, why do we care? Either way, wouldn't the Merenholtz have it?
No, because if it's condition subsequent, then Harry could come and say. Because so if it's fee simple determinable, it automatically goes reversionary to the Merenholtz. But if it's condition subsequent, the person who set the condition then has the right to come in and say, "Well, this isn't fee. Use how I want it."
Kind of. It's like unfortunately more complicated than that.
In some ways, if we were in a jurisdiction that follows the modern rule, whether it was a power of termination or a possibility of reverter, it would have, by this logic, ended up in the Merenholtz hand somewhere. We would just be debating about whether or not it automatically went back to them or whether they had to kind of exercise their right to take it back. And it would be kind of this trying to figure out what date it was theirs and whether they waited too long. Instead, however, at this time in Illinois, they still had some of the common law rules lingering. And this isn't a super old case. They still had some of the common law rules lingering about which types of future interests you were allowed to convey. So remember I said at common law that you could only pass these things by intestacy. But the modern rules that you could sell them to somebody or transfer them to somebody or pass in your will. So, but at this time, Illinois is still prohibiting inter vivos conveyances of both of those future interests, which means end device. So you could not pass, the only way you could pass on those things was by inheritance. So notice what that restriction means. That means that this purported sales from the Jacques Vins or whatever their names are, those purported sales of the future interests or even the Huttons giving their future interests, none of those were valid. So the Merenholtz can't claim their land, their future interests along those lines. All right, so now if they can pass that future interest via intestacy, they did then pass it in 1969 to Harry. Harry did get it. Now, Harry, though, still cannot pass it inter vivos, so he's still not allowed to sell it to them. So because we put these weird restraints on it, you see it actually kind of really limited what could be done here. Now, instead, what we would probably want to ask then is in 1969, we'd have to look at what right Harry had. Okay, in 1969, when did they stop using the school for school? The land for school?
1973.
Okay, so in 1973, so Harry's got the land. In 1973, if it's a fee simple determinable, that is when he became the landowner. If it's a fee simple condition subsequent, when did he become the landowner? Has he exercised his right of reentry? Not yet. He hasn't done anything yet. And then the court, every jurisdiction usually has something about like not letting people wait too long to do it. But so you can see how one of them, he is the landowner, and he then, therefore, a 1977 transfer would have been totally valid. If he's not the landowner, a 1977 transfer wouldn't be valid. Of course, the case ends up remanding to try and figure out some of these details, and it does not turn on any of this. Did you see how they resolved this case in the end? It's mentioned at the end, right? Sam, you see it?
Yeah. Didn't they say that storage is actually a school function?
Yeah. So all of this long dispute of whether it's fee simple determinable, what the rights are going to be in Illinois for alienation, and at the end of the day they said, hey, wait a second. We're just going to actually read school purposes to be a lot broader. School purpose doesn't necessarily have to mean a school. Now, this is something that does come up in conveyances when we're reading these fee simple determinables or these right fee simple condition subsequents, and we're trying to figure out, has the condition happened? Well, sometimes courts will read it quite broadly, right? Because they don't like to kind of have people be divested of their property. So school purposes could be, that's probably helpful to the school to have it used as a storage someplace. How far you take that? Like, what if the school runs a store there and they use the money from that store to
fund the school. That's going to be up to a court, whether or not they think that's still within keeping of the school purposes.
All right. Any questions about those two? All right, let's take a break, and then we'll do some examples and stuff.
Can you help me with this one? The product is speaking to
Chicago.
To a piece of land in the city of Chicago. And
who owns this property right now? Or who's in possession of it? So who is it? Who is it in Tacoma that owns that is possesses this land? Names of the party here. So the Park District, but the Park District is it's part. It's the city itself, right? The Park District is the one who's kind of operating land, but it's the city that is claiming that they have possession of it. Where did the city get this land from? Right, Tacoma Light and Water Company. Where did Tacoma Light and Water Company get this land? Here again, the case name gives us a hint. From the Rigneys, but not from the ones that are still alive. So this is why it's the heirs of Rigneys that are bringing this case. This is a 1965 case. What year was the land transferred to Tacoma, to Tacoma Light and Water?
1884.
1884, a heck of a long time ago. 1884, Rigney and his wife conveyed property to the Tacoma Light and Water Company by a deed. And what did it say in the deed? What was the? Why did they convey this property to the Tacoma Light and Water?
For the purpose of providing a right of way to conduct fresh water by each mouth, room, or other pump for the supply of the city of Tacoma and its inhabitants.
Absolutely, right? So we can see that they had a specific interest in conveying this, right? That they wanted there to be access to water, and that's why they conveyed this land. Because they didn't want to just, they were not just giving this to them for any reason, they kind of created, they gave this land in a limited way, and in a defeasible, some type of defeasible fee. Here is like the kind of somewhat confusing language that was in the deed that conveyed it. If at any time thereafter the company, said company, the Light and Water, its successors or assigns should cease to stop use of said, cease to use said strip of land for the purpose of conducting such water, then it shall be lawful shall and may be lawful to and for said party of the first part of their heirs or assigns to thereby re-enter and have the same again, repossess and enjoy this property. Okay, right, this is what happens when you read a 1984 deed, plus you have one of my typos in there. Right, that it's like kind of this confusing, cumbersome deed. But what does this look like, Elise? What type of property interest do we think that they have created here? It's some type of defeasible fee. Which of them?
Conditions.
All right, what made you reach that conclusion as opposed to fee simple determinable?
Because it has this condition of providing.
Yeah, what words in here are helpful? I think we have some confusing words. In some ways, if at any time thereafter sounds durational, but we have actually, we have then, which kind of sounds durational to me as well, but we have actually very strong language here of the right to re-enter. Right? By saying the right to re-enter, that sure sounds like a fee simple condition subsequent. Now, if you have a fee simple subject to a condition subsequent, what is the future interest that goes alongside that?
The grantor.
Yeah, what does the grantor have?
The simple.
That's what they will have it if they can get possession. But they have some future interest. So every time we create one of these defeasible fees, we're creating a present interest, a present possessory interest, and as you correctly labeled it, a fee simple subject to condition subsequent. That's our present possessory interest that the Tacoma Light and Water have. Now here's the problem. If that's their present possessory interest, what is the future interest that we say retain? What do we call that?
Is it right to make entry or power to creation?
Exactly. Right? Those always go together. If you have a fee simple subject to condition subsequent, the future interest is called the right of re-entry. That's nice little hint in there of like I'm actually mentioning re-entry in there. Now remember what we just learned about the fee simple subject to condition subsequent. What point does that future interest become possessory? Christian?
When the transfer exercises the right to re-enter.
When the transfer exercises the right to re-enter. Okay, now that must mean there's a condition subsequent. What's our condition subsequent here? Charlotte?
Water use.
Yeah, the failure, right? Their failure to use said strip of land for the purpose of conducting water. That's our condition. We have to look at that condition and figure out what happens. If this was a fee simple determinable, the date that they stopped using the land for water, it would have gone to Rigney's heirs. If it's a fee simple condition subsequent, the date they stopped using the water, it doesn't automatically go. They just get this right of re-entry that says they could come back in and take that land away. All right, Elise, can you help us with this? When did they stop using the land for conducting water? Roughly how long ago did that happen?
1905.
Yeah, somewhere around there. It says 1893, I think, is when they stopped using it. 1905 is when, well, they conveyed it to the city, but I think 1905 is when it stopped being used for water, and they set it aside for park purposes. All right, so now we have 1905, maybe you could say 97 when the park district takes over, but definitely, 1907. So 1905, this case is brought in 1965. What we really see in this case is a question about how long you can sit on that right of reentry and not exercise it. If it had automatically transferred back in 1905, and this was a fee simple, it had been a fee simple determinable and it automatically transferred back, who do you think should own the property today? Back in 1905, it automatically transferred back to the heirs of Rigney. Yeah, Allie? All right, so 1905 is when they got title to it. It's 1965 today. They still have title to it? Arthur thinks so. Will says no. Any argument for why they should have lost their title? Will? It's a really significant amount of time. Adverse possession. Do you see how this works, right? So if you have a fee simple determinable and you automatically lost your property in 1905, but you stayed there and kept using it for 60 years, and the landowner who had title never came and did anything to it, that's exactly the circumstances for adverse possession. And Sam, you asked the question earlier, who's policing this? Well, if nobody's policing it, it's not going to be enforced, right? So we could see this. But now, so we actually kind of feel not too bad about that. That seems relatively straightforward. If you were the property owner in the past 60 years, you've never done anything about your property, and somebody else has been occupying it, that's totally our case for adverse possession. We feel like we understand that. What's more challenging is the heirs didn't actually get the property in 1905 because they didn't have an automatic power termination. They didn't have a possibility of murder. It didn't automatically go back to them. They had to undertake an affirmative act to get the property, and they have not yet done so. How long do we let them sit on their hands and watch this property being used for a different use and not actually exercise their right of reentry? Is it okay that they show up in 1965 and try and exercise their right of reentry, or should we stop them from doing that? What do you think, Elise? Should we allow them to now exercise their right of reentry, or have they waited too long? What do you guys think? How many people feel like we should let them exercise it? There's two of you. How many people think that they've waited too long? Almost all of you. All right, who said, Sam, you think they should be able to come in and exercise it now?
I understand the adverse possession claim. I understand the logic behind it now.
Yeah.
But I think it makes sense, especially where there's no idea of notice that's being mentioned here. So I feel like if you inherited an estate that you had no idea that you inherited, and you found out 60 years later, I think you should have some right to it, because the original person's intent, the original person had ownership, intended for you to have it, because he was using it for water.
Well, that's interesting. You know, that sounds a lot like the rules we use for personal property, though, right? That seems more akin to things like the discovery rule that we talked about kind of with the paintings. We don't use such rules usually for real property. Because we want real property to kind of not have all these kind of encumbrances and restraints on it, we want it to be used productively. And the idea that somebody could, like, not pay attention for 60 years, and you're right, maybe they had no idea until it was like published in the paper or something. But we still tend to say they kind of have waited too long. Maybe there's somebody back there they can blame. Maybe there's some attorney or something they should be yelling at. Charlotte?
I wonder about the issue of, you know, productive use. Currently, the property itself is turned into tennis courts or something that are currently destroyed and kept and can't be used, but it sounds like productive use. I guess the only other caveat is, you know, if it were private land, then I would say, sure, go for it, try to get it back. I think there's a little.
Do you think there's something different here that we have a public, that it's because that's public land?
It's a public policy issue here in regard to how the land is being used. It's very, you know, it's being used, although derelict now, for, you know, the government,
yeah,
the community, and so forth. So that might throw.
So I see where you're coming from, and, you know, I see both of you actually have very fact-specific reasons for wanting to kind of support this. But if we're just kind of thinking what we think a better general rule is, we might be a little bit hesitant to embrace these people that sat around for 60 years before exercising their right of reentry. Maybe Sam's rule about maybe we wait until when they knew about it would work, but mostly letting them sit around feels wrong.
Is it really exercising my right, though? Because the city brought the action, so they only know because the city is actively, affirmatively taking it.
I think that actually helps Sam's argument. Like, I think that's the whole point. It's like maybe they had no idea that they realized they even had a property right here until the city brought the action. But either way, it's still the same question, though, is of whether or not they can get the land back too long or whether or not they've waited. The court says this is too long. We cannot use adverse possession because we can't really meet the requirements of adverse possession with these right of reentries. because it doesn't have the same, doesn't always meet a jurisdiction's feeling for what a standard for hostility would be. Because in some ways you are allowed, it's a right of reentry. There's some time you're allowed to let them sit there before you exercise your right. You're not required to exercise it automatically. But how long can we let somebody sit there? Now, this is 60 years. What if it had been 5? What if it had been 2? How long should we figure it out? The courts don't have a general rule on this. This court says unreasonable delay. Right, so then we think of kind of our tort principles of reasonableness to try and figure out how long. They said the holder of a right of entry cannot endlessly sit by refusing to declare a forfeiture and thus control the use of the property indefinitely. Right, so think about that, what the threat would mean if the person, maybe the person does know the entire 60 years and they're just kind of holding it over for you. Like, anytime you do something wrong, I might take this back. If you're not nice to me, I have the power to take it back. They said, we don't like that. But it is just an equitable doctrine. This is not a statute. This is not even clear case law. This is just kind of balancing the factors and feeling like this is unreasonable. And this is something we also see happening in property. A use of kind of a court's equitable powers when they think that somebody's being unreasonable. So, they have kind of not a clear rule, but I would say most jurisdictions find that the period used in that jurisdiction for adverse possession is often a very good number. They often, even though they're not required to use that number of years, it often seems to be good evidence for them. They'll often be like, well, our adverse possession statute is 15 years. This was 16. That's probably unreasonable, even though it's just kind of a balancing factor. All right, let's not do future interests, and instead let's do some problems about conveying the land. So I'm going to pass things out to you. I want you to not work alone. I want you to turn around and pick a couple people and talk these out with. And what I want you to do in these is think about how you would write the conveyance. Right? So what I'm trying to get at here is, I want you to think about what's the type of property estate that would be good. Should this be a feasible determinable? Should it be for such a feasible subsequent? And if